What up, all those people? What's the crack on the... Oh,
the what?
What's the crack? Is that a thing they say in Northern Ireland?
It's an Irish thing.
What's the crack?
It's like, what's up? What's popping?
What's the crack?
What's the dealio?
But if you say it with an English accent, like an American accent...
What's the crack?
What's the crack is what I'm saying.
Like an American accent.
Yeah, yeah. It's like...
What's the crack?
It's stupid.
But it's like... It's not... It's like spelled... It's spelled Irish, like super weird. Like there's too many vowels.
Good.
It's like there's a Q in there, I think.
I can't remember. Irish is a very vowely spoken language.
Yeah, like, yeah, it's interesting.
Love it.
Who are you?
Oh, just a little nobody named Emily.
You're a somebody to me.
Thanks, dear.
And I am Marguerite Virginia, who's hopefully a somebody to you. Well, I was talking to the people listening. So,
and welcome.
We are the ladies of Millennial Poet Society.
We are a weekly podcast that talks about poetry, as you can probably assume. But we
didn't you get that from the intro?
We each pick a poet or two a week, and we discuss their life and their work. And sometimes we have special topics and. That's what we do. And
it's a grand old time.
You listen and you love it, so we keep doing it.
Uh-huh. And we love it. Even if you didn't listen, we'll keep doing it.
But hello, please, is anyone there?
Please listen. Anyway, great. So that's good. Who we are. We have this segment that we are not currently doing called Who's to Say? That we just finished season one of that. It is where we feature unpublished or self-published poets that send in their work or sometimes some of our own work and share one of those, give a little bio, some background, and just share work of people who we feel or they feel whatever that they want to share their work with the world and get more people's voices out there. So if you would like to send in your work for that to be considered, please email it to millennialpoetssociety@gmail.com. You can find that email address right in the description of like the show notes of this episode, or you can also find it on Instagram if you search MPS_podcast. You can go find us there, give us a follow, and then click on either the contact or email button that's there to send us an email with some of your work. We want to read it.
We love getting emails.
Yeah, we're getting ready for season two, so send it on over so that we can read it and share it.
I just got really distracted because it's super windy outside today.
Like, is it really?
Yeah, I'm watching. We have this little like... streamer thing on our balcony right now, and it's blowing,
At
least it was just now. It was like gusty, man.
I have zero windows in my office, so I literally have no idea what the outside world is like. I like walked out of the office at one point today, and I assumed that it was like gray and rainy, and then I went out to like take a phone call, and it was so nice out, and I was like, wow.
I was really just pushing my own agenda on this weather today.
Because I was really hoping I wasn't missing anything nice out there.
Nope, you missed a glorious day.
Wonderful. Good to know.
It was very pretty
from
up high in the sky today in Midtown.
Yes.
But...
fun. Well, what do you, are you doing anything fun soon for your Up High in the Sky office?
Yes. We're doing this fun little thing on Thursday that's like a UN lunch. Mm. And everybody is bringing in something from the country or the state or the region that they are from or that they represent or that they resonate with or whatever.
So cool.
I'm bringing in, since I'm part Lebanese, I'm bringing in homemade baklava or badlewa, as it's supposed to be pronounced in Lebanese. So I am bringing in this really delicious recipe. It's like it's a family classic. It's not a family recipe, but I think it's from this book of recipes, either from my mom's old church, like the Lebanese Catholic church, or it's from this Lebanese festival that used to happen every year in Wheeling, West Virginia, where my mom grew up.
Cool.
But it's this delicious recipe with lots of cinnamon and walnuts and orange slices and honey and like, ooh, it's really, really good. It's like a staple, and I only ever get it at like the holidays sometimes because it's time consuming to make. And so my family like makes it as a unit.
Yeah.
And I'm trying it for the first time on my own tomorrow, which would actually be Thursday. So we'll see.
So yesterday,
by the time
this comes out,
or Wednesday. Yeah. So by the time this comes out, we'll know if it was a flop or not, but I have a feeling it'll be really good because it's just a good recipe in general. Mm-hmm. But so yeah, I'm excited. New things are happening.
Very exciting. Do you make the actual dough or do you get it somewhere?
No, I get the dough. Cause like that would take forever. Is ridiculously. Yeah.
Put like, your Great British Baking Show skills to use.
No, thanks.
You don't want to do that?
I don't want to make puff pastry dough, oddly enough. Actually, it's not puff pastry. It's phyllo. I do not want to make phyllo.
Yeah. That's one where you have to have all the butter layers, right?
Yeah. Every layer gets butter. So I use a half pound of butter in this 13x9 recipe.
Like, it has to be the perfect amount of butter, but the butter can't like melt and you can't like...
Oh no, yeah, you can. Well, so...
Like when you're making the dough, I mean.
When you're making the dough.
The layers.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's puff pastry. Because phyllo dough comes in actual thin sheets already.
But like when you're making phyllo dough, like if someone were to make it.
I don't know that anybody on Great British Baking Show ever made phyllo dough.
Really?
It's that super, super thin, you lay it out in individual sheets.
Yeah.
Not like a puff pastry that is that lamination that has to happen.
I'm pretty sure there was some episode where someone made phyllo dough.
Well, they were insane.
I feel like I remember it being
like, oh my god, it's so windy. Sorry. Every time Mark looks, it stops. But I'm looking at it and it's going.
Sure.
Yeah, the wind. Ooh.
Oh, it's so windy out.
Don't go away.
Oh my god.
Yeah, so anyway, that's what I'm doing this week. It'll be really fun. And
I volunteered to be a taste tester, but she doesn't think she's gonna have enough for me to taste test.
Yeah, we'll see. My office is huge and I'm only making one pan, so they might already hate me if I only have like 30 pieces,
Everyone's bringing food in, right? There'll be plenty.
They better be okay with me just bringing one pan because it's a lot.
I mean, yeah. Well, and you've got to bring it all the way there. Yeah.
Yeah. But like people make, like there are people making like dinner, like actual entrees and stuff for everybody. Or what they do, actually, that's not true. What a lot of people do is they order it from somewhere, like a catering place.
Yeah.
And then they have it, which is cool. But like,
yeah, but so I think it's understandable that if you're making something, you don't have to bring a full like 50, 60, 70, whatever,
130 portion, or more.
130 portion baklava.
Yeah, like. No, I'm going to go ahead and make one pan, but it'll be fun. So I'll be doing that late tomorrow night.
Nice.
Yay.
Nice. Very fun.
Yeah, what about you? Anything exciting in your life? Or are you just really... This is boring right now.
I didn't prep for this. What were you going to talk about? I didn't come up with anything.
Oh, great.
I have to rent a car later.
Oh, no. This is awful.
I have to do adult things
this
and
is
rent
not,
a car.
Not good content, Mark. Nobody wants to. Nobody cares about your car rental.
Do you want to know about the things that I forgot to do today? I need to rent a car. I need to do my dishes.
That's good.
I'm going to hang some pictures, maybe.
I could tell you about another cool thing I'm doing.
I just remembered my life is kind of cool.
What's the cool thing you're doing, Emily? Aside from everything, I'm also... I'm sorry. That sounded so mean. I didn't mean it like that. I didn't, I swear. But I am reading a really cool book right now.
Oh, me too. Did I talk about it already?
I think you did.
Okay. Okay, you go.
I'm reading a different really cool book. And it's a Stephen King short stories collection called Night Shift.
Uh-huh.
And I just finished the first story called Jerusalem's Lot, which is also known as Salem's Lot, which is one of the first things he wrote. But yeah, it's a really cool like spoopy novel.
Spoopy!
I'm a big fan of like really leaning into the fall spooky atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Like going to see a scary movie or listening to or reading spoopy books. Mm-hmm. So aside from the Stephen King collection, I'm also listening to Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson, which is very interesting, but not nearly as scary as I wanted it to be, which is actually kind of nice. It's like a palate cleanse, but still in that like kind of haunting
thing. Bay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm doing. That's all.
Great. Fun. You have lots of things going on in your life, and I'm just doing my thing, renting cars and doing dishes.
Those are very adult, mature things for you to do. Well done. I'm proud of you. So great. That's it.
Well, yeah, that's our lives right now.
And if you want to tell us about your lives, which we definitely want to hear about, you should email us.
Email us. Or we'll talk about them. We'll share stuff about your life.
Message us on Instagram. We'll talk.
DM us. Slide into our DMs.
We are always, we are actually really great sounding boards. So if you ever have like ideas about things you want to hear on the podcast or about writing that you're thinking of doing, we love that stuff.
Send it on over.
Send it on up.
All right. So this is 27.
It is 27.
Which means you.
It's me.
Go first.
Yes. I go first. I am continuing, oh yeah, I was like, oh no, I forgot, but I'm continuing my feminism and poetry segment, and I did not remember a feminism fun fact this week, but that's okay because it's the
feminism
same.
Feminism fun fact, Greta Thunberg gave a really cool speech at the UN thing this week.
Feminism / climate change. Yes, Greta did, and that is more for like the current like fourth wave feminism battle.
Yeah,
that slide. It's a fun fact. I forgot. but I'm continuing with the second wave feminism this week because there was another author poet that I really wanted to talk about last week, but I had a lot of other stuff to say.
Great.
So this week I want to talk about Diane Wachowski and all of the wonderful things she did for poetry, has done, and is still doing for poetry and feminism.
Yeah.
She is a poet and essayist she was a poet and essayist very famously during the time of the second wave feminism movement, and the third and fourth too, like I said, because she's still kicking. Mm. She was born in Whittier, California on August 3rd, 1937. Her work is often associated with the deep image poets.
She's still alive?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, as of when this Poetry Foundation article was written, which was recently, or at least updated recently.
Oh, that's only 82.
Yeah.
I don't know why that seemed like
years ago.
Continue.
Okay. Her work
I was like, she's like almost 100. Sorry.
Oh my God. You were like, continue. And then I was like,
thanks.
Her work was often associated with the deep image poets as well as confessional and beat poets of the 1960s.
Cool.
So if you're like me and you don't know what deep poets are, or sorry, deep image poets are,
all poets are deep.
All poets are deep. But deep image is a term coined by U.S. poet Jerome Rothenberg and Robert Kelly in Trobar magazine in 1961. Rothenberg was inspired by the Spanish cante hondo, or deep song, especially the work of Federico Garcia Lorca, and by the symbolist theory of correspondences. So in general, deep image poems are resonant, stylized, and heroic in tone, which I think you'll see in the poems that I chose. Longer poems tend to be catalogs of freestanding images. This style relies on the writing being concrete, not abstract. It encourages the images to make the experience and generate meaning for themselves. This style of deep image tended to be narrative, but was often lyric as well. So, Diane Wachowski earned a BA from the University of California, Berkeley, where she studied with poets such as Tom Gunn and Josephine Miles. Wachowski is the author of over 60 published collections of poetry and prose.
Wow.
So many.
Many.
Her poems focused on intensely personal experiences while at the same time inventing and incorporating themes, characters. I wrote themes twice. Themes, characters, and themes from mythology and archetype.
Ooh,
which is really cool. Right, we've talked a lot about that. On her blog, because yes, she has a blog.
I love it.
You can check it out at dwakoski.com.
Nice.
Wakoski has written of her life. On her blog, she speaks of her writing, saying that it includes a lot of chants and incantations, and through creating mythologies that function using trope that lead to revelation as some of her main themes and important like aspects of her writing. Wakoski also strives for her poems to have a voice that is, quote, wholly natural, spontaneous, and direct. Aren't we all, though,
yeah.
Honestly?
Don't we all want to be?
There are often themes of the failure of relationships or of betrayals by others, especially men, present in her writing. And many of her mythological figures embody one or more of the facets of human relations in which she sees the possibility of betrayal or loss. Her many collections of poetry include series stretching across multiple books, such as The Archaeology of Books and Movies, whose titles include Medea the Sorceress, Jason the Sailor, The Emerald City of Las Vegas, and Argonaut Rose. And all of those were published between 1991 and 1998.
Cool.
But they become this one collection, The Archaeology of Books and Movies. The series investigated the mythology of modern America through movies and pop culture, personal history, geography, and a series of textual allusions. Wakoski was also a prolific writer of essays, and her collections include Form is an Extension of Content, Creating a Personal Mythology, Variations on a Theme, and Toward a New Poetry. Diana's been honored with a Fulbright Fellowship,
wow,
a Michigan Arts Foundation Award, and grants from the Guggenheim Foundation.
Guggenheim.
Thank you. The Michigan Arts Council, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the New York State Council on the Arts.
Wow.
Yes. She has also taught for many years at Michigan State University, hence all the Michigan stuff. When discussing her poetry and American poetry in general with the Poetry Society of America, Wakoski claimed, quote, American poetry is always about defining oneself individually, claiming one's right to be different and often to break taboos. America may be a melting pot, but most American poets think of themselves as separate, different, and while very specially identified with some place in America or some set of cultural traditions, it is usually about the way in which they discovered their difference from others and proudly celebrate them.
Hmm.
A brief list of just some of her writing, written work include Coins and Coffins in 1962, her first collection, the George Washington poems from 1967, Inside the Blood Factory, 1968, the Motorcycle Betrayal poems, 1971, Dancing on the Grave of a Son of a Bitch, 1973, which
I've heard of that one for
I'll be reading that title poem
okay.
tonight. The Man Who Shook Hands, 1978. The Collected Greed, Parts 1 through 13, 1984. Emerald Ice, Selected Poems, 1988. And her most recent one, Lady of Light, published in 2018.
Wow.
Yeah. So awesome. She's still just like
doing
cranking it out.
Yeah.
So I had two options here. I'm not sure. I think maybe I want to read both of them. Okay. The first one I definitely want to read. It's called Dancing on the Grave of a Son of a Bitch. And I just really like that title.
Yeah.
I
may have come across it at some point. The name sounds familiar.
It's quite possible. But so there's this really interesting foreword that she wrote for the poem that I want to read to you as well.
Mm-hmm.
Forward to Dancing on the Grave of a Son of a Bitch. This poem is more properly a dance poem than a song or chant because the element of repetition is created by movements of language rather than duplicating words and sounds. However, it is in the spirit of ritual recitation. However, it is in the spirit of ritual recitation that I wrote it slash a performance to drive away bad spirits. The story behind the poem is this. A man and woman who have been living together for some time separate. Part of the pain of separation involves possessions which they had shared. They both angrily believed they should have what they want. She asks for some possession and he denies her the right to it. She replies that she gave him money for a possession which he has and therefore should have what she wants now. He replies that she has forgotten that for the number of years they lived together, he never charged her rent, and if he had, she would now owe him $7,000. Mm. She is appalled that he equates their history with a sum of money. She is even more furious to realize that this sum of money represents the entire rent on the apartment and implies that he should not have paid anything at all. She is furious. She kills him mentally. Once and for all, she decides she is well rid of this man and that she shouldn't feel sad at their parting. She decides to prove to herself that she's glad he's gone from her life. With joy, she will dance on all the bad memories of their life together. For my motorcycle betrayer. God damn it! At last, I am going to dance on your grave, old man. You've stepped on my shadow once too often. You've been unfaithful to me with other women. Women so cheap and insipid, it psychs me out to think I might ever be put in the same category with them. You've left me alone so often that I might as well have been a homesteader in Alaska these past years. And you've left me, thrown me out of your life often enough that I might as well be a newspaper, differently discarded each day. Now you're gone for good, and I don't know why, but your leaving actually makes me as miserable as an earthworm with no earth, but now I've crawled out of the ground where you stomped me, and I gradually stand taller and taller each day. I have learned to sing new songs, and as I sing, I'm going to dance on your grave because you are dead, 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 under the earth with the rest of the shit. I'm going to plant deadly nightshade on your grassy mound and make sure a hemlock tree starts growing there. Henbane is too good for you, but I'll let a bit grow there for good measure because we want to dance. We want to sing. We want to throw this old man to the wolves, but they are too beautiful for him, singing in harmony with each other. So some white wolves and I will sing on your grave, old man, and dance for the joy of your death. Is this an angry statement? No, it is a statement of joy. Will the sun shine again? Yes, 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 because I'm going to dance, dance, dance. Duncan's measure and Pindar's tune, Lorca's cadence and Creeley's hum, Stephen's sirens and William's little Morris dance. Oh, the poets will call the tune and I will dance, dance, dance on your grave, 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 because you're a son of a bitch, a son of a bitch. And you tried to do me in, but you can't, can't, can't. You were a liar in a way that only I know. You ride a bike, a broken motorcycle. You speak a dead language. You are a bad plumber, and you write with inkless pens. You were mean to me, and I've survived. God damn you, at least I'm going to dance on your grave, old man. I'm going to learn every traditional dance, every measure, and dance, dance, dance on your grave. One step for every time you've done me wrong.
Wow.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Such an anthem. Wow. So empowering. And like that exactly, I think it really just shows off her ability to write lyrically without it having to be like pretty. You know what I mean? Like it's definitely that deep poetry, that deep image poetry that she's talking about that she really wants to get across to the reader. I think it's just like she, I mean, the fact that the whole story is explained in the foreword is super helpful.
Yeah.
But, and it like lends it to the power behind it and like how you should probably read it if you're going to read it out loud or if you're going to read it just on the page. But I love it. It's so empowering and it makes me want to also scream like, yeah, fuck you, man. Like, that's shitty of you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I really love that poem.
No, I really love it. All of just the sounds and the repetition, like we were talking, you were talking about earlier, like, it's just very powerful and strong and like hits at just the right times and everything.
Right. Yeah. And she's right that the movement of the language, rather than the duplicating words and sounds, which are also there, but the movement of the language is really what's bringing that element of like dance to it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's so cool.
Yeah.
That she didn't have to rely on the chanting portion of it to make it a chant. You know what I mean? I think that's so
cool.
Yeah. So. I
love it.
That is her poem, Dancing on the Grave of a Son of a Bitch. I also just really like saying that name.
Mm-hmm.
And then this poem, I think, is more, shows off more of her ability to write and why most people would probably see her as, like, a feminist writer. Not that the other poem wasn't, but this is just much more about, like, female empowerment and, like, yeah.
Okay.
It's called Belly Dancer. Mm-hmm. Can these movements, which move themselves, be the substance of my attraction? Where does this thin green silk come from that covers my body? Surely any woman wearing such fabrics would move her body just to feel them touching every part of her. Yet most of the women frown or look away or laugh stiffly. They are afraid of these materials and these movements in some way. The psychologists would say they are afraid of themselves somehow, perhaps awakening too much desire that their men could never satisfy. So they keep themselves laced and buttoned and made up in hopes that the framework will keep them stiff enough not to feel the whole register, in hopes that they will not have to experience the unquenchable desire for rhythm and contact. If a snake glided across this floor, most of them would faint or shriek away. Yet that movement could be their own. That smooth movement frightens them, awakening ancestors and relatives to the tips of the arms and toes. So my bare feet and my thin green silks, my bells and finger symbols offend them, frighten their old young bodies, while the men simper and leer, glad for the vicarious experience and exercise. They do not realize how I scorn them, or how I dance for their frightened, unawakened, sweet women.
Hmm.
I just like that because it's like taking something that is so hyper-sexualized and in the male gaze and making it for women.
Right.
And really empowering women to be like, if you embrace this, they can't hold it against you.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer something that is for men. It is for women. It is for empowerment instead of sexualization. Although those two things can be hand in hand.
Right.
That's not to say that like sexualizing something isn't empowering.
Or feeling sexy.
Right, exactly. But it makes it so that you have the control.
Right.
Women have the control over the situation. And I thought that was, it's very conversational. It's very prosy, even though it's written out like, cut up in stanzas and stuff. But I really like the way she writes. It reminds me of a speech or like a declaration. But it's all packed up in this pretty little poem form. So that's Diane Wachowski, my second and final, second wave feminist poet. And
love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Awesome. Well, we will take a short break and then be back with my poet.
Yay!
Yay.
We'll be back.
Pasta. Now we are.
Yeah?
Pasta night.
Cool.
Carb night.
So it's decided.
We used to have pasta parties on the swim team to like get ready for big swim meets. Yeah, we would have.
Yep.
Texas toast or like some other kind of garlic bread. They would make pounds of pasta.
Yeah.
And it was funny because I remember my mom one time. So one of my brothers used to be on the swim team and she would do like pasta nights for the guys swim team.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was like hosting her first one, I guess maybe for like me when I was on the swim team. And she was like, I don't think I need to make as much pasta as I did for the guys, but like I guess I'll just do that and like we'll have extra, like whatever. It was devoured.
Yeah
It was spaghetti and meatballs, garlic bread and salad. everyone just like ate the shit out of all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would swim real good.
Yeah. Anyway.
So, my turn.
Your turn. Who are you doing?
I am doing Nick Flynn.
Flynn or Finn?
Flynn.
Oh.
What?
In the Google Doc, it says Finn.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, it's Nick Flynn.
Great.
I'll update that.
No, it's fine. I'm cool.
Yeah. But so he is one of the poets that I found when we were checking out a new bookstore.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So there's a couple of them in New York City, right? The bookstore?
The Greenlight.
Greenlight. Yeah. Yeah. So we were checking out this new bookstore, and I found a book by Nick Flynn, one of his collections. And come to find out in doing my research, because this the book, I didn't find it, like, this collection in any of the information about him. And so I was like, that's so strange. Like, why? I was like, it must have come out recently. It came out on September 3rd.
Like, so we were there Sunday the 15th. But
okay, so a couple weeks after. But still, very new. And I just happened across it. I liked the cover. And so then I read, like, flipped through the pages and found a... our neighbors cooked some dinner and it smells real good.
Sorry. I'm like,
and so if you hear, Emily go, she's just sniffing the delicious air.
I'm just a memory.
But so anyway, that's how I discovered him, and I was trying to figure out who to do this week, and I was like, hey, well, I may as well. I found this book. I didn't buy it yet, but I would like to. I instead spent all my money on buying Sapiens, but, but I'll be back for Nick. So about him, he is an American writer, playwright, and poet.
Playwright.
Yes. He was born in Massachusetts in a town that I can't skituate. It's S-C-I-T-U-A-T-E.
S-C-I-T-U-A-T-E.
Skituate.
Skitui.
Anyway, Massachusetts, on January 26, 1960.
Oh, he's my mom's age.
Yeah, so he...
Sorry, Mom.
I'm like, does she care? Do I need to get that out?
She better not.
He was raised by his mother in a suburb of Boston, so it's kind of near Boston.
Must be.
If it's a suburb, yeah. he had no contact with his father throughout most of his childhood and adolescence. His parents split when he was 6 months old. Growing up, he was discouraged from being a writer because his father had identified himself as a writer to his mother when they first met. And so she was like, writers are bad.
His mother was like, yeah. It was a Coco situation. Don't be a musician. You're a great grandfather, you know?
I haven't watched it yet.
You haven't watched Coco?
No.
The amount of times you've heard me crying in my room to that movie is astounding, and you've never watched it. So that
really makes me want to watch it after hearing you crying in your room.
It's so good!
Gets you the first time. So yes, similar to Coco, I suppose.
Y'all know what I'm talking about.
Nick claimed the reason for his parents' separation was his father's, quote-unquote, delusion of greatness and identifying it very directly with his being an artist.
God, that's like the worst kind of person.
I know. Yeah. Unfortunate.
That's unfortunate.
Nick had various occupations before eventually becoming a writer, or professionally pursuing it. He was an electrician. He became an electrician after graduating high school. And unfortunately his mother completed suicide when he was 22 years old. And after that, he left his childhood home. So it was just sort of like moving on.
That's heartbreaking.
He worked as a ship's captain. Some other occupations he had, he worked as a ship's captain, and he worked at a homeless shelter in Boston before he was awarded a fellowship from the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown. And after that two-year fellowship, he moved to New York City, where he earned his MFA from New York University and taught in Columbia University's Writing Project. Interesting fact, when he was working at the homeless shelter in Boston, he unexpectedly reunited with his father at the homeless shelter. Because his father at the time was homeless, and the name of the shelter was the Pine Street Inn. And so where I found this, it said like his then homeless father showed up as a quote unquote guest. So Flynn, in his memoir titled Another Bullshit Night in Suck City, he examined his relationship with his father and the suicide of his mother, and his sort of examination of like family and what he went through in life, right, and that sort of thing. The relationships that he had is a big theme in a lot of his work. He explored his decision to have a child in his second memoir. I put in quote, like parentheses. I was like, aren't you only supposed to have one memoir? But because it's like it's a memoir. It's, I don't know. I don't understand memoirs. So maybe that's not.
Well, no, that's like a.
That's a biography, I guess. Or no.
You're really only supposed to write about yourself once. Because a memoir is like an autobiography. But
yeah.
It's like.
But he has, like a trilogy. He has three memoirs. He has a trilogy.
I mean, so like Maya Angelou had multiple memoirs.
Yeah.
Maybe memoirs are more like essays.
Yeah.
About like lessons in life that are like anecdotal to your life, maybe.
Yeah.
But like an autobiography, you really should only write once.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I just thought it was kind of funny because I was like, a second memoir. Okay.
When I think of people that have multiple memoirs, unless they have done something truly great, and like Maya Angelou, for example, I'm sort of just like,
Well, apparently
who's crying out for more from you?
Apparently his memoirs were very good. And,
oh, I'm sure
and
they are.
Whatever.
I think it's funny.
His second memoir where he explored the decision to have a child and whatnot is called Ticking is the Bomb. Or The Ticking is the Bomb.
I get it.
He then wrote a book of poetry titled The Captain Asks for a Show of Hands, which also addressed similar themes. His book, The Reenactments, is the final book in his trilogy of memoirs. Mm. I don't really have too much information on what that one was about, at least not in this. I don't know if I talk about it again. His initial focus was on poetry, though, and he held a fellowship, like I said, at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, Massachusetts, and then went on to pursue his Master of Fine Arts. He was a member of Columbia University's Writing Project, as I said, and taught there. He also served as an educator and consultant in New York Public Schools.
Cool.
His work has been featured in The New Yorker, Paris Review, NPR's This American Life, The New York Times Book Review.
I love This American Life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've talked about it before.
I bet he has, like, they have every once in a while, they have, like, segments where they will accept either prose or poetry or something, mm-hmm. like stories that on the theme.
That's you may have heard him. And his work has been translated into many different languages. His first book of poetry, Some Ether, published in 2000. My emphasis on words is very strange right now. Published in 2000. 2000. How do you say that? In 2000.
In the year 2000.
2000.
Okay. 2000.
2000.
2000.
Anyway.
Well, because 2018.
2018. 2000.
2018. It's 2018, not 2018.
2000.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it is. 2018. 2000.
Nothing.
This is the hard stuff. This is what they want.
Anyway, this collection of poetry won the Penn Joyce Osterweil Award and the judges said about this collection that these poems establish their emotional authority through their very movement, their wayward, whispering music, at once reckless and demure, outrageous and delicate.
Wow. It's praise. I mean, it's...
No, I know. I'm just looking at you, looking down at your phone, and then there's a pause, and you go, wow. Like, oh, I'm supposed to say something now.
No, I just, like, actually was listening, and I was looking up which This American Life episode he was on.
Ah, okay. Did you find it?
It's in the archive. I didn't look too hard, because I had to say wow, so I was... I was also sort of...
Because I took a pause and you had to yeah. respond.
Yeah. But I was listening. Mm-hmm. It's high praise. It's yes. pretty cool.
Most of the poems in Some Ether focus on Flynn's tumultuous family life and include a detached yet affecting look at childhood and trauma. His work has been described as post-confessional, primarily because of his poems in Some Ether, which focus on his mother's suicide when he was 22, his difficult childhood, and his stilted family life. In Blind Huber, one of his other collections, however...
I've heard of all of these.
Yeah.
Some Ether is super familiar to me. Blind Huber?
Mm-hmm. Or it's H-U-B-E-R. Huber? Huber? Yeah.
Huber.
I'm assuming it's Huber, not Huber. Blind Huber.
Blind Huber.
The poems in that collection, Blind Huber, eschew Flynn's history and focus on the life of the blind beekeeper, Francois Huber, who lived yeah. in the 18th century, which is interesting, an interesting concept.
How are you a beekeeper when you're blind? Maybe that's what he writes about. You should read the book.
While the subject matter may differ dramatically in all of Nick Flynn's works, there is there's a struggle for connectivity and disjointed and harsh
What? Let me try that again. I was paying attention that time and I didn't get that.
Oh, God. While the subject matter may differ dramatically, in all of Nick Flynn's work, there is the struggle for connectivity in a disjointed and harsh reality.
Yes.
Yes.
Moving on.
As Claudia Rankine noted about Some Ether, we are guided by a stunning and solitary voice into lives that have spiritually and physically imploded. No one survives, and still there is so much to be felt. Here is sorrow and madness reconciled to humanity. Mm-hmm. Flynn's written about his family in both poetry and prose, and about that, he says, "The way I write, I don't see much distinction between the two, although prose seems more suited to daylight and poetry to night."
Oh, yes.
Isn't that a cool... I liked that sentiment.
I agree.
He said, "I try to cook both down to some..." You are, like, pushing the table into me.
I'm so sorry.
Slowly. It's just creeping. I'm, like, leaning back onto the couch.
sorry.
He says, "I try to cook both down to something essential. By the daylight..." I didn't read correctly. "I try to cook both down to something essential. By the end, hopefully some balance between mystery and clarity remains."
I'm sure that is accurate.
Yeah. So Flynn is the author of books of poetry, including Blind Huber, published in 2002, The Captain Asks for a Show of Hands in 2011, My Feelings, published in 2015, and has also written several memoirs, including Another Bullshit Night in Suck City in 2004, Being Flynn in 2005. The Ticking is the Bomb in 2010, The Reenactments in 2013, and a play titled Alice Invents a Little Game and Alice Always Wins in 2008.
Interesting.
Yeah. Isn't that a cool name?
I bet that is a quote from Alice in Wonderland.
Maybe.
Or yeah. It's about Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah. His memoir, Another Bullshit Night in Suck City, received the Penn Martha Albrand Award and has been widely translated and was adapted into the film Being Flynn, which, you know it?
Yeah.
That's about him.
No way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes, in fact, it is.
Actually, yeah.
Crazy.
He was awarded the Discovery/the Nation Prize and has received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Library of Congress, and the Amy Lowell Trust. Flynn teaches creative writing at the University of Houston and splits his time between Houston and
Brooklyn,
New York.
Yes. I knew it was about something I knew. So Robert De Niro, Paul Dano, and Julianne Moore are in this movie.
Oh, jeez.
I never saw it, but it came out in 2012.
We should watch it.
We should. It sounds
Oh, that's so cool. I didn't look it up specifically.
Like, wow, there's so many people in this.
Wow. Very Focus cool. Wow. Everyone go check that out for more info on it Nick Flynn. It did
not do well at all.
Oh, well.
It only grossed $540,000. Yikes.
So, his writing's real good.
Robert De Niro plays, oh, Jonathan Flynn. I was like, what? Paul Dano plays Nick Flynn. Interesting. Okay. I think I'd like that.
Cool. We should watch it.
Yeah.
Great. Well, so I'm going to read one of his poems from his collection called I Will Destroy You Poems.
Cool.
And that's the one that I found in the bookshop.
Yeah.
Which was published on September 3rd, which is really cool.
Very cool.
So, but this actual poem, that I'm going to read, it's the one that I found and really, I showed it to you when we were in the bookstore.
That's right.
And I'm actually just seeing, I hadn't noticed it before, so it's online on poets.org. And he actually wrote this specific poem in 2016 for their Poem a Day, series that they do.
Hey, Poem a Day. So, we love those.
Yeah.
We should do another one soon.
Yeah. Yeah, we should.
With October coming up, you know?
Mm-hmm. We can do a spoopy one.
Spoopy poems only. Oh, no.
Good. All right. So this is called Tattoo. Wait, before you start reading, are you going to read the last three lines that you forgot to show me?
Yes, because they're not on another page. Yeah. They're on the same page.
Okay. Just making sure. I found the end of the poem after Marguerite did, even though she showed me the poem. She was like, isn't this great? And I like turned the page. She was like, that's it. And I was like, no. That was the middle of a sentence right there.
I was like, there's no more. Why are you turning the page?
I was like, there are three more lines at least.
Good.
So this is Tattoo, the complete poem. You do know, right, that between the no longer and the still to come, you are being continually tattooed, inked with the skulls of everyone you've ever loved. The you and the you and the you and the you. You don't sit in a chair, thumb through a binder, pick a design. It simply happens each time you bring your fingers to your face to inhale him back into you. Tiny skulls. Some of us are covered. You, love, could simply tattoo an open door. Light pouring from somewhere outside. You could make your body a door that appears. You, let her fill you, are made of light.
Wow. Yeah, I like that.
I like that poem a lot. And I just really love, like, I feel like I can just picture, like, someone being, like, covered in these tattoos or, like markings of just all the people they've loved. And I love the idea of something visual that people leave, like, on mm-hmm. you. It's like people always leave their mark on you or that sort of thing, but it's like that's not something you can see necessarily. So the right. idea that it's like you're just covered in these like invisible
permanent
tattoos,
ink
and it's just like it's just there, but then you find this person who doesn't leave this skeleton or whatever. It's this person fills you with light. So it's like they're not necessarily leaving their mark in that way. It's they're filling you and leaving their trace by like the light that they bring to your life and right. bring into you or bring out of you.
Right.
They open a door.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that idea. And I like to picture people with all of these like varying levels of tattooedness.
Yeah. Yeah.
like a baby. Mm-hmm. Would have like one or two mm-hmm. tattoos.
Yeah.
But then like, I don't know, somebody my age would have, like me in particular, mm-hmm. who falls in love all the time. Just like
sleeves.
Sleeves on sleeves. And like, we're mm-hmm. running out of room. I have to go to the face and the inner lip uh-huh. and like, just like really just covered.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's such a cool way to visualize people.
Yeah.
And love.
I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As like, as these little permanent markings of affection.
Yeah.
And the fact that he chose skulls,
mm-hmm.
too, like, why? I wonder why. Like, was that a metaphor because he feels like love is dead?
Well, or yeah, like, I mean, it could be something for, like, all, like, the people that you've loved through life. And, yeah, people that are maybe no longer in your life or that sort of
loved
thing.
And lost. Or, yeah.
Or, yeah, I don't know. But
then to have that one door.
Mm-hmm.
So cool. I really like that.
Yeah. So that was Nick Flynn.
Everybody watch his movie.
Watch his movie. yeah, and I really want to read his, I mean, more of his collections. But I will have to save up my book allowance and go get his collection.
Get rid of a few
time.
Other ones first.
Oh my gosh, I know. Yeah. Our library is full.
I've started a new one in my room.
I need to. Ugh. Yep.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
And thanks for sharing.
Yeah. Mark. Yeah.
If you guys don't forget to submit all your stuff to our Who's to Say pool, whatever. What are we calling it? Submissions? You know, like little, like
the dead pool, the Who's to Say pool.
You know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Don't forget to do that. As always, we want to give a quick shout out, thank you to Zach Adkins for his intro and outro music. Also, a shameless plug for him, he just wrote an EP, and the first song is available on Spotify now. Look up Dexter Hall. It's very good. And then also, if you follow the link below in this, like the show notes of this episode, you can take the link to a support page where you can donate as little as 99 cents a month.
Dollar menu donations.
Said with, which means that with for much less than a coffee, you can give us access to new microphones, a better recording space, somebody to help us edit this podcast. So poor old Marguerite can get some beauty sleep.
You know what
finally.
I did? You know what I did last week?
What?
I don't know. I don't think you even noticed. I didn't say anything to you.
No.
So I was like so ahead, like on top of it last week.
Really?
I got it done at like 9:30 because I had other stuff I needed to do.
Yeah.
So I got it done. Got it completely like ready to publish and whatever. And I thought I scheduled it to publish. And then like at the end of the day, Friday, I like got on to Apple Podcasts. And
you
saw
didn't
that
post us?
No.
Marg!
I posted it on Saturday. And
Marg!
Like, no one noticed, right?
It's my God. Our 15 listeners noticed. Listen. No, that's hilarious.
But I was like, of course, the one time that I'm ahead of schedule, I fuck
right.
it up.
Well,
like,
we went out on Friday night, so.
Yeah. Well, but not Thursday night. Like,
yeah, you know what to do. Like our page. Subscribe.
What's happening?
Oh,
thanks for being here.
We really appreciate the fact that you're sticking with us.
Thanks. Great. Talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye. What's that thing from Buddy from Elf? Bye, Buddy. Hope you find your dad.
Thanks, Mr. Narwhal. He like comes up and all the other animals are like, ah!
He's like, bye, Buddy. Hope you find your dad.
Hope you find your dad.